I'm Dylan Lee, obviously. I'm doing my honours at Victoria University in Melbourne. And this has been the main part of my project, forensic timeline analysis of ZFS. So first of all, I'm going to sort of introduce timeline forensics and what makes ZFS special to forensics and the existing research. Then I'll go through all the structures I've looked at, and there'll be a short demonstration at the end. So yeah, first of all, digital crime scene investigation for forensics. Very common thing forensic investigators are asked to do is to just build up a timeline of events over time, files being written to and saved, deleted, and so on. The process of building that is called timeline analysis or event analysis or timestamp analysis. The main source of data is the file timestamps, but you also look at internal file metadata like change tracking in Word documents, stuff like that, registry logs and so on. You take all those sources and you build up usually a super timeline for all of those. Most of these sources, it's basically trivial to falsify. Obviously, timestamps, you can just change it with touch or many things by switching the system clock around. So we have the problem of detecting when timestamps are being forged. The main technique that's used is simply to cross-check all those different sources, registries, logs, and so on. That's automated by the super timeline tools. And the big problems with that, apart from the fact that all of them are forgeable, is that you can't always find an entry in a log or registry or somewhere to corroborate the timestamp of any file. So it helps if you can use some other internal data of the file system to help corroborate the timeline. There are existing forensic tools that do that, but they don't handle ZFS disks. So talk a bit about what makes ZFS special. I assume everyone here is familiar with ZFS, basically. Most forensics tools still assume the structure of combining disks into a volume, then maybe having partitions on a disk and file systems on top of that. Whereas in ZFS, with all this added to a pool storage, most tools aren't equipped to handle that sort of structure. Internally, for those who don't know, this is fairly abstract view. Internally in ZFS, everything is basically an object in a tree. There's up to usually 1 to 3 copies, usually redundant copies of each object, and they're just put on different devices. Each pointer to the next object in a tree is actually up to 3 pointers, point to a different object, also contains a checksum. So ZFS can tell that if one of the copies is, compare one of the copies against the checksum, if it's bad, use another copy, it's good. If that's good, we write over the bad copy. So for forensics, it's important to understand the ZFS transactions. All writes to a ZFS pool are copy on write transactions. They're batched up in a transaction group, which are typically written every 5 seconds, can vary depending on a few things I'll go into later. Transaction groups are identified by a transaction group ID. This is a very useful thing for forensics, I've found. When the transaction is written, new objects are written from the bottom up, basically in the tree, linked by these pointer structures which have multiple references and the checksum. And finally, at the top of the tree, there's an uber block. A new uber block is written. The uber block is where the tree is sort of rooted. There's multiple sets of 128 uber blocks for redundancy. So there's some existing ZFS forensic research, but not very much. Probably the most comprehensive article that's been done is by Nicole Langbeeb and some others in digital investigation back in 2009. Digital forensic implications of ZFS, it's a general overview of some of the advantages for forensic investigators. Like the copy and write mechanism means that there's usually lots of multiple copies sitting around on the disk that helps. There's a lot of disadvantages too. Compression makes a lot of things more difficult. There's a lot of tools that expect to be able to locate files based on magic numbers and things like that, but if the data's all compressed, then that data's going to change. Like the article says, implications of ZFS, it is based purely on sort of theoretical examination of the documentation and the source code at the time. There was no empirical analysis of actual file systems, so they haven't actually tried writing stuff to disk to confirm that, you know, what they suspect might be useful is useful. Doesn't provide any particular techniques or guidelines, just talks about what might be useful. There's also, there is a bit of research in the area of data recovery. Max Bruning has written a lot about data recovery. And that article, the ZFS on disk data walk, is very useful. If you're trying to find sort of from first principles where some data is on ZFS disk. As a student at Macquarie University also wrote a simple ZDB enhancement for locating known data within disk. This is similar to the way forensic file carvers work. So if you, there's some data you're basically trying to locate, if you know what some of that data is, it'll try and find where that file is. But it's not really a timeline tool, which is my focus is on timeline stuff. There's also an article published more recently about anti-forensics techniques and obfuscation on ZFS. That was published in Revista IEEE America Latina. So unfortunately, only the abstract is available in English. So my project basically is to determine sort of what timeline information we can actually get from the ZFS structures, what's the event information. Because there haven't been, I've done analysis on actual file systems on disk. It's not just theoretical. And found a few techniques for both verifying timestamps and detecting, you know, forged ones. The practical aim of this project, finally, is to develop, apart from all the research stuff, is to develop some new forensic timeline tools that can actually be used to add more data to that super timeline. So, our experiments. We had ZFS pools with 1 to 9 disks with various configurations, mirror, RAID Z, and so on, where they were appropriate. We had simulated file activity based on corporate network file storage statistics. There's a few studies we took data from. The main one was this one, ASIN transactions and storage. That was based on Microsoft, done by some people at Microsoft. It was based on their internal network storage and the activity there. I also looked at my own systems as case studies just to sort of make sure that I'm looking at some real world systems. For each pool are at least 3 experiments. There's one where there's no tampering, one where I put the system clock back an hour while a file was saved, and one where I use touch to also change the modification file time of a file back 1 hour. So we can examine how that sort of falsification timestamps affect the ZFS data. Every 30 minutes, we saved as much data from as we could using ZDB. That wasn't always possible because this was while the file system was changing, so sometimes ZDB would crash when it's trying to save all the object tree, but most of the time we were able to get things. So start going over the structures now. First of all, top of the tree is the Uber blocks. As I said, they're written every 5 seconds at a steady load. Occasionally, one will be committed more frequently, but usually they're every 5 seconds. I believe that's tunable, though. You can change that. So to extract from ZDB, it's per device, as you can see. Sets may differ between top-level virtual devices, particularly for 3 or more, when you've got pools with 3 or more disks. I'll get into that later as well. Each Uber block includes a block pointer to the meta object set, which is sort of where the tree starts, transaction group ID, and the time it was written. So there's an example here. See the magic number, Uber block. The main useful things for forensics are the transaction group ID and the timestamp, simply because it provides a way for us to link those two together. Okay. This big structure here is the root block pointer. You can see there's 3 pointers to 3 different copies of that first object in the tree. Block pointers also contain their own transaction group ID. Yeah, as I said, link to the time it was written. we can use uBlox to detect forged timestamps. We just simply compare the transaction group on ID on the file to the transaction group in the uBlox. You know, if the timestamps don't add up within 5 seconds, then you know, there's something unusual going on. Consecutive uBlox, as their TXG increases as well, the timestamps should increase, but barring sort of clock corrections or things. So that can also be used to determine if someone's switched the system clock back to falsify a timestamp. There are a few disadvantages. It's relatively easy for someone to tamper with the uBlox itself because it's at the top of the tree. It's only got its own checksum to change. Whereas if you change the checksum in other objects further down the tree, you have to go back up and correct everything, which is more difficult. Also, they typically last just over 10 minutes. Because there's an array of 128 uBlox and they're written every 5 seconds, that's 640 seconds usually. We did find though that where there's pools with 4 or more top level virtual devices, they can retain uBlox for longer because a single transaction might not touch all the each disk in the pool. Because ZFS saves usually three copies of metadata, if you've got 3 disks or less, then everything will be spread across those 3 disks. But you start adding more disks, then sometimes disks won't be touched in a transaction. That said, at the very peak, the highest outlier was only 2.4 hours. Away before they started getting overwritten, so they're still not very useful. It's mainly useful in some sort of dawn raid scenario where you're kicking down the door of someone who's deleting files. In that sort of extreme situation, it'd probably be quite useful to look at the previous versions of the tree. So even though we were collecting data every 30 minutes, it was only successful in 50% of the cases because the rest, the uBlox, had already been overwritten. Where they hadn't been overwritten, though, it was nearly always successful. So the next is for file objects in a data set. So ZFS data sets, sort of where things are useful, things like files and block devices actually stored in ZFS. So data set could be a file system, could also be a snapshot or a clone of that snapshot or a ZVol, which is like a block device that's exported. You can have lots of data sets in a ZFS pool, of course. Metadata has to be extracted in this way per data set with the -d and -b options. They'll give you all the objects and the block pointers in the data set. I'll show you some examples in a minute. There's some data set specific objects like the delete queue we haven't actually looked at in detail. There's directory objects, which is mainly a name value list of file names and their file object ID. The main one we've looked at is the file objects, which include all the file attributes and the block pointers that point to where the file data actually is. So that's an example with a few fields cut out for clarity. Obviously there's the modification times there. The gen value is generation transaction ID when this object was created. So that comes in handy later. There'll be at least if the file isn't empty, there'll be at least one block pointer here pointing to where the file data is actually stored. So there's several useful things for forensic purposes in the file object. First of all, the object number. All objects in dataset have an ID number that increases. So if someone changes the creation time of the file, then the object number will be out of order unless they change the object number too. So this is just comparing the object numbers to identify ones that are out of order. That was successful in all the experiments where file creation time was modified. Can't be used to detect any change modification time because the object numbers is fixed at the creation time of the object. Yeah, so that's an example here. This is over the course of 3 hours where this object was created here and basically it was falsely claimed it was created at that time. But it's quite easy to detect. Similarly, the generation transaction group, transaction group IDs increase as well. So they can be used just like the object number to detect when there's an out of order object creation. Again, successful at all times when detecting a false creation time, but cannot be used for false modification time. Note that this graph is very smooth too, because transaction groups are written evenly every 5 seconds, whereas the object one, that rate varies with the rate at which files are created. So the block pointers in file data I found are actually the most useful one thing I've looked at for forensics. So block pointers contain the transaction group when they're written. So as I've already mentioned, this can be cross-referenced to transaction groups from block pointers in other files, and in Uber blocks and other things that store transaction group ID. This is successful at detecting all forms of tampering in all the experiments, basically just by looking at transaction group ID and modification time. And those should increase in order. Something's out of order, something unusual is going on. Because they're written every 5 seconds, transaction groups, you do need 5 seconds of tolerance there because some files could have been written in that 37 second, a transaction group in 37 seconds past a minute, the modification time from the user's point of view was 32 seconds past a minute, but they'll all be written at that 37 second mark. There's another useful thing about file data block pointers that you can, it's also possible to get the past modification times in some cases. So this is some data that you can't, not just verifying data, this is forensic event information that you can't even get from file timestamps themselves. The way this works is for larger files, it needs more than one block pointer basically to point to the file data. So if there's block pointers that have been written in the past and not changed more frequently, then they'll have a transaction group recorded as well. So you can cross-reference that transaction group to other files in the pool that were written in the same transaction group to get the date that part of the file was modified. So this is only effective for large files, like that are updated in small isolated parts, like virtual machine images. That's probably the perfect case. For files any large files that are updated, you know, where the whole file is changed, like for some sort of compressed archive or something, then this won't be effective because all the data will have to be rewritten. So yeah, here's an example of a large file. This is, I believe, what's called a gang block in ZFS. So the first block pointer actually points to a set of other block pointers, which point to the actual data. Yeah. And this is a canned example I've got, so it just fits in the slide. But these, for large files, you'll have many, many, many block pointers to go through. I'll try and show some demonstration. In this example, we've got a file that was written most frequently at transaction 15853. So that's when the parent block pointer was written, and that's when this part of the file was written. But we can see that this segment was written at an earlier transaction group ID, 15464. So all we have to do is cross-reference this transaction group with another file in the pool and get that modification time, so to determine the time at which this segment was written. Okay? That's information you can't normally get from the file timestamp. Okay, now this just shows sort of what I've just explained in a bit more detail. This is the transaction group ID vertically, modification time on the left, so you can see they're completely linear, but file creation time on the right. So all these dots up here are where a file was written at this point, but then modified later. So you can cross-reference to there for large files with several block pointers. Cross-reference another file at this point to get the time at which that segment was written. Finally, space maps. These were the least effective of all the things we looked at. space allocation in ZFS, there's sort of a few parts. First of all, you have to pick which of the devices you're going to store data in. It uses a round robin algorithm, switching devices every 512k. With each device is then divided up into equal size regions, metaslabs. ZFS tries to fill metaslabs before using new ones generally. And then once you pick some space in a metaslab, that the allocation free information is stored in a space map object. So first of all, virtual devices. The round robin algorithm means that there's some order as to the writing of in which virtual device data is written to. I did look into using this to verify timestamps, but because there's so many transient files, and not just files, but transient objects, such as new space maps and new objects that are written every time there's disk activity, there's so much other stuff that's constantly being written and deleted that it breaks up any sort of pattern in the virtual devices. Could possibly be useful in some sort of write-only workload, theoretically, but I don't think that's going to work. If you want to have a look at the metaslabs, they're extracted per pool with the dash M option to ZDB. There's one set for each top-level virtual device. Each metaslab has a space map with many segments. So there's a very abbreviated example here. So this is for one metaslab at covering a certain point of the device. There's many of these allocation-free segments. Now, as you can see, they do have transaction group IDs. However, that transaction group ID is not when the allocated space here was written. It's when this space map itself was written. That's why they're not so useful, basically. They're just, space maps are just lists of free blocks, and they're log structured, so everything goes to the end, but ZFS condenses them when it detects that there's lots of allocation frees that cancel out. So although each segment stores the transaction group ID when it was written, that's probably the transaction group ID when the space map was later condensed. It's not the transaction group ID when the space it's allocating was written. So because of that, and because there's so many transient files have always been and objects have always been created and destroyed, again, prevents it from being useful for forensics to detect tampering or to verify timestamps. Could theoretically be useful to verify the minimum age of a file, because you know that the space map specified in the transaction group ID specified in the space map might be more recent than when the file was written. Certainly can't be older, but again, that's verifying the minimum age of files isn't something that really comes up very often, so I don't expect that to be useful. There's a few plots here just to show you what the average longevity is with the condensation. So this is the modification time of the files. This is after 24 hours in an experiment. This is the modification time of the files. So it's fairly even. You can see it's slightly skewed towards the present, medium, 55% writing of files. But all the space maps transaction groups are skewed quite strongly towards the present because this gets so frequently condensed and rewritten. One of the things we did notice, though, is that pools with more redundancy tend to have a lot more earlier outliers of space maps. Not quite sure why that is exactly. But it definitely increases with redundancy, yeah?
Were those pools with mirrors and RAID Z larger?
Don't think so. Well, the disks, the virtual devices were all the same size, yeah.
But was the total pool size?
No, larger? No, it wasn't.
So you had the same number of devices in each case?
Yeah, same number of devices. Yeah, that might have been why. Yeah. Of course, all of this stuff about how long they last is highly dependent on the workload as well. And like I said, we used this studies based on file activity, mainly this one at Microsoft, also several others, to determine the statistics we used for writing of files. So with different sorts of workload, different sorts of machines, it's going to exhibit very different activity anyway. Okay, just before I get to the demonstration, so a few observations. So, summary table. The thing that most stands out here is that block pointer transaction groups in the file data are by far the most useful structure. They can find everything. They can find things that can't be found with any other method. Forge creation time is clearly much easier to detect than forge modification time because it affects the creation of an object. There's a lot more metadata that is out of order. Whereas with modification time, it's pretty much only the block pointers that are pointing to the actual file data that you've got. Also, Uber blocks, as I mentioned, only effective if they're collected within 10 minutes, basically. False positives. There's a lot of perfectly valid and innocent reasons why you might have a mismatch between the timestamp and some of this metadata. Clock corrections are sort of the obvious one. It'll affect all the timestamps. And without considering context of the files and so on, it doesn't appear to be any different to the tools than a clock correction doesn't appear to be any different to tools than someone deliberately tampering with the clock to change the file. In two of the experiments, we had a clock correction by NTPD overnight that was flagged as a timestamp falsification where there was actually nothing going on. You hopefully, contextually, in actual investigation, that should be fairly easy to recognize because the clock corrections will affect sort of everything on them, and they'll be at 11 p.m. at night or whenever the cron job is or whenever the correction is, rather than just the files that you're interested in. There's also several reasons why there might be user space change to the timestamps. That will appear to the tools to be no different than someone deliberately falsifying timestamps using the touch command. But if you unpack archives or copy or move files or things like that with timestamps preserved, then that'll appear to be the same. Again, investigator just has to use the context of the files that are flagged to determine if that's a false positive or not. One that got flagged a lot on my own systems was files that had been installed from ports or installed during an upgrade, because the installation uses a preserve flag when copying the files, so that all the permissions, like set UID or so on, are preserved. It also preserves the timestamps. So if I build a port and it takes a while, and then 5 minutes later it installs some files that were built 5 minutes ago, that will appear to the tools to be exactly the same as a deliberate falsification of the timestamps. As I mentioned before too, it's possible for someone to tamper with the internal data of ZFS to match up with their falsification timestamps. Uber blocks would be the most easy. Anything else that's further down the tree, you need to correct all the parent checksums as well. And in all the multiple redundant objects as well. So certainly not impossible, but would involve a bit of work. Object number and the generation transaction group could be changed fairly easily, providing there's a viable false ID or transaction group to insert into. In real disk, where there's lots of activity and lots of IDs and transaction groups being generated, that's probably likely that there's a viable one. If there isn't a viable one, then you'd possibly have to rewrite the entire disk. Again, not impossible, but difficult. Block pointer transaction groups could also be changed, but you need a bit more care to keep the order consistent. Space maps might be more difficult to alter, although they're not really very useful, as far as I can tell, for forensics. And the alteration would probably be indistinguishable from any condensation that happens regularly anyway. So, now, I have a demonstration. So, I'm just going to create a new pool. I allocated a few some space first. So there's our new pool with two disks, or two partitions. Let's create a few files. I'm not sure if it's possible to, just have to do that all the time. Another tank. So yeah, I'll create a few file systems in that pool. Or did I already do that? Oh, right. I'll do it from scratch. So it'll probably help. Okay, create a new pool. Create a few file systems in that pool. Okay. Thanks. Okay, and just create a few files with some random data. Oh. I meant that to be file one or file two. And file three. Okay, so there's our files. If I now want to create a file and pretend, create a new file that is falsely at 7.16. I think this laptop's still on Melbourne time. Yeah, 7.16, okay. So I'll change the time to 7.16. And now create file four. Oh, thanks. Okay, so file four now appears to be created before any of the others. I'll just create a few more. You know, these files might be modified, so I'll just append a bit of data to some of the earlier files. Okay. Okay. Ah, thanks. Okay, so now I'm going to use ZDB to have a look through at the data. The dash P is for parsable, so that doesn't abbreviate. If you've got 1.2 megabytes of stuff, it doesn't abbreviate to 1.2M. It keeps it as the raw value. Dash UU. Most options in ZDB, that provides increasing verbosity with more, if you repeat the option. So with UberBlocks, it goes up to 3. And then you use dash L to specify the device. So our devices there. That cut off. Okay, I might put that through less so we can read it. Okay, so that's the UberBlock. It's actually the label, really, at the start and end of the virtual device, which includes some configuration information about the pool as well as the UberBlock. So they start here. So that's UberBlock 4, created in transaction group 4. That would have been when the disk was created and so on. Now, if you scroll down to 7.16, as you can see, the transaction groups are increasing and timestamps increasing. Keep going down, and also as you can see, they're written every approximately every 5 seconds.
sorry?
Yeah, ZDB. There's actually I'll get to it at the end, there's a quick reference, which is really just a list of all the commands on the site if you want to run those yourself and have a look. If I gone off the screen again. Where was that? Run that through grep. Yeah, grep timestamp. We can see here where it's gone up to 7:17:06, and I put the clock back to start making the fake files, the false timestamp files. So even though these are consecutive Uber locks with consecutive transaction groups, you can see the clock going backwards. The main stuff comes from the data set information, so I'll extract that. Thanks. So B is for block pointers. There's up to 6 levels of verbosity, and D is for the data set. Pool demo FS2.
So there
are 10. That's right. Thank you. Might want to pipe that through less again as well. Okay, I wonder if I can, I might be able to scale that. Yeah, switch. Yeah, is that better? Okay, it's on the screen. Is that smaller? Okay, so this is the data set from ZFS. So start off with object ID 0. That's the DNA that basically encapsulates all the objects. And these are, this is an example of some of the block pointers. So this is a set with a lot more gang blocks because it's a very large object. It starts with level 6, pointing to many level 5, and then level 4 and level 3, level 2. It's only the leaf nodes, once you get down to level 0, that actually point to data. There's some more data set specific or file system specific objects. There's the ZFS master node, system attributes. There's the delete queue, which is something I haven't had a chance to look at yet, but could be possibly useful. Then we get into the first directory object. Yeah. So yeah, that's the root directory object of the file system. The contents of the object, like I said, just a name value list of the file names and the object number of that file object. So we've got a few more data set specific objects here. And the directory before I get to the first file. So that's, if I go back up to the directory. There we are. You see that file there, the first file. It's object ID 8. So yeah, that's the first file, object ID 8. Generated in transaction ID 11, so this wasn't one of the fake ones. All the creation times listed. It's got, got 2 megabytes in size. Because it's a large file, requires lots of gang blocks to store its data. Typically, ZFS records are only at most 128K. So you, in this example, because I've just capped a few seconds of dead random to a file to create several large files, but actually usually you don't get this many block pointers. Usually most files fit into less than 128K, so you only get one. All of these have, these are all storing 128K. See the size there, 20,000 hex. These all created at transaction 11. You can see from the birth transaction group ID there. Once you get to the, I'll skip ahead to the file that I actually falsified. what was that, file four. Okay, so this is the object for file four, the one where I falsified. As you can see here, that creation time is at 7.16.04, so earlier than the first file we looked at. But the generation ID, which hasn't been tampered with at all, is 32, so clearly out of order. The object ID itself, 11, is greater than 8, so that's also out of order. And the block pointers here, this points the point to all the file data, they're all created at 32. So there's our three ways that we can tell that the file's been created with a false creation time. If I scroll down, you might see that I'll just skip ahead to the next file and go up. Yeah, so this is the end of that long list of block IDs pointing to this file. And so these ones are creating transaction ID 36. So while I was cutting data to that file, it actually was written in transactions between 32 and 36. So if this was part of a larger disk, a real disk with lots of activity, we could look at those earlier transaction groups and get the numbers 32 to 36, cross-reference those with other files to get the timestamps that those segments of this file were written. How am I going for time? Okay. Finally, I'll go through the Metaslabs. Feel free to ask questions too if there's something you particularly want to look at. I'll go through the Metaslabs, /M. Less again, forgot. Okay. Yeah, so this is the Metaslab information. So this will be per virtual device. There's two here, so it'll be two sets. There's 175 Metaslabs in this disk. So this is the first one. This data is it's all listed here as transaction group 15. A lot of this data actually would have been allocated in transaction group 4 when the disk was created. So if I go back to the data set list, you can see here that this, where are we? Master, yeah. So that's the master node of this file system. This was created in, this was written in transaction group 6. The pool itself was created in transaction group 4. Some of the pool objects were being allocated then. But the earliest transaction group in the Metaslab is transaction group 15, because some of this data and some of this would have been allocated in transaction groups earlier than 15, but it's been condensed later. So that's why we can't get, we can't use the transaction groups in the space maps to verify timestamps. So as we go further on, you'll find there's other transaction groups here and other listings, but again, we don't know for sure that all this stuff is allocated when it had the listed transaction group. Okay.
Did you look at snapshots and how those would be used to see if someone falsified information?
No, we haven't yet. I actually have a long list of futures work, things we haven't yet looked at that I plan to get to, and snapshots is definitely something on the list. Yeah. We didn't look at snapshots at all, and obviously there's something that's very heavily used in ZFS, so it's definitely something you have to do.
Did you create any tools to do this kind of like correlations of timestamps and things like that, or is it all just kind of procedures?
I created some. For most of the experiments, I wrote a Python script to convert all the ZDB stuff into XML, and then that was imported into R. And I did all sorts of statistical stuff in R to look at the data. We tried a lot of things on things like the space maps, like association rule group mining and other techniques that didn't come up with anything that worked with space maps. Whereas with some of the other things, like the block pointer transaction, I go, that's just a linear relationship. That was incredibly simple. My plan, I do intend to probably cribbing some of the code from the Python scripts to create a input plugin for the log to timeline tool. That's a common open source super timeline tool that aggregates data from lots of sources. So I'm going to write an input module that will let you put this sort of ZDB data into the super timeline. Yep. Before I go back to the slides, anything you want to see? Yep.
If I'm a criminal, should I use or not use ZFS?
Would
I be better off with a different file system?
Probably better off using ZFS because there's a lot less tools and things are generally more difficult. There's a lot less research. You know, people don't know what to do with it. So there's this timeline forensics. There's a lot of things ZFS does that actually make forensics incredibly difficult. Two in particular, compression, because data is compressed, you don't have all the magic numbers at the start of files. And a lot of forensic tools expect to just search from one end of the disk to the other and find magic numbers to find files. You can't do that with the compressed data.
Compress my data?
Yes, compress your data. Also, because so much of ZFS is dynamically allocated, that makes it difficult. With a really simple file system like FAT, of course, everything's very static. It's easy to find where something is, whereas with ZFS, there's about 10 different objects you have to trace through just to find where file data is actually stored.
So you sort of hinted at this, but can you draw a correlation between the kinds of events that you can detect, i.e. forged files versus deleted files versus that kind of stuff, the degree of difficulty required to actually affect that change if I was a criminal, and maybe some kind of how likely that is to be done, or how valuable that sort of activity is.
Yeah. I guess this sort of falsifying timestamps doesn't come up that often in forensics. I think it's important because it does come up in one very important case though, which is when evidence is forged en masse, or part of an evidence source. Like if police are, or someone corrupt is taking a disk that's of evidence and changing something on that disk, maybe inserting a report or inserting an email or something on that disk, and then claiming that, you know, you knew about this. Why didn't you? You knew about this occupational health and safety problem, whatever. Why didn't you do anything about it? I sent you a report 2 months ago. That's the sort of thing that you can detect with this, and that's why I think it's very important. It also comes up a bit with student assignments. You do get students who submit a deliberately corrupt Word document. There's even sites that sell them. And then, a week later, you email a student, say, oh, I got your assignment, it was corrupted. And they say, oh, I'll bring you my USB stick. I've got it on here. Look at the modification times. I haven't touched it, haven't done anything since last week. That's the sort of thing that's useful with this. But for most cases don't involve falsifying timestamps. Where in most cases this research would be useful is in just the getting the extra modification time for the large files. That'd be handy.
So what are the use cases that you would get a disk or a bunch of disks that have ZFS on them and need to do this kind of forensic analysis?
This timeline analysis and building a super timeline would probably be the basic part of any investigation. Like a time that you always want a timeline.
Like, is this the cops bust down my door and take my laptop because they think I'm pirating, or is this corporate crime and you're doing discovery or
either of those cases. Yeah. those are probably the two big ones though. You get forensics, in police forensics, people seize laptops, desktops, whatever, and they need to be investigated. There's usually a lot of automation there because, in the Australian Federal Police, if you've got a really big case, like a drug ring, or a big child porn ring or something huge, you might get 2 weeks to work on the systems on that case, if you're lucky. A typical case that I look at, you'd get a day, maybe half a day. They really want automated tools to, as much as they can, to collate event data so they don't have to go through things in detail. For corporate cases, there is a lot of cases where you've got dealing with disgruntled employees who you want to investigate. Did they insert something they shouldn't have, or do something they shouldn't have, or cases where, like the example I just made up, where someone claims, "I sent you a report 2 months ago, you didn't receive it." Those ones actually, you typically get a lot more time to look at things because money is no object to the corporation. Yeah.
Yep. Two questions. One is, how easy would it be to script up an en masse timestamp modification script?
It's not that difficult, actually. I teach computer internet forensics at MIT. And for a few years, actually, we've been using a system where we generate 2 gigabytes or so of false data en masse for the students. And we generate based on their student ID. So each one gets a new, each one gets a completely different, unique set of data. But it's not difficult to create it, but using this sort of analysis, it's very easy to detect that it's false. Yeah.
Second question is, how does this affect, how would using file systems on top of ZFS, like on top of Zvols, affect this kind of analysis, timestamp analysis, like UFS on top of ZFS or NTFS?
Zvols is one area where that sort of the using the block pointers to get past modification times is really effective because it's that sort of perfect use case for it, perfect scenario for it, really, where you've got a large object, many block pointers, but it's only modified in small parts. So in that case, where you could use the block modification times from the ZFS block pointers to verify some of the timestamps in the file system that's actually on the Zvol.
So you had like a Word document or some medium-sized, like say 1 meg file, and you wanted to go through and look at which of the techniques would you recommend to actually going to look at that? Because I know you mentioned the block pointer one, or one of the techniques is only really good for bigger files, just for your average nerd.
The issue with the larger file, that's only for getting past modification times. So that you need big files for, that only modify in small parts. But for verifying timestamps, you can use block pointer transaction groups for any sized file for any sort of timestamp modification or creation. I better just, because we're running out of time, I'll just finish off the talk and I'll maybe take a few questions after. So I'm nearly done. As I said, I've got a long list of future work to do. There's my next steps for this. Real data would be better than this simulated data, although I've got real data from my own systems. I need much wider source. So the next phase of this project is to do a survey of actual pulls from production systems. So I've got a script that just goes through the ZFS data and rubs out file names and paths, replaces them with generic ones like file 2 or file 12, directory 3, and so on. And I'm hoping for looking for volunteers to anonymize their data and submit it to the survey when it's ready. The other thing I'm working on, like I said, the automation. I've used the Python scripts in the experiments. I'm planning to adapt that into a log-to-timeline input module. So that's already in progress. There's also a lot more structures to examine. Some I've already mentioned, the per dataset objects. ZFS intent log, so that's basically a log where synchronous writes are written, but that log could be on a separate disk or within the pool. But when synchronous writes are written there, then they're just later written to a transaction group and the log entry is just sort of forgotten. So I believe, as Beebe's already mentioned in her examination, there could be lots of interesting data in 10log. We haven't looked at that yet. Pools with snapshots, we haven't looked at that yet. That's obviously a source where you could have lots of historical data that could be useful for building up events. All the objects in the meta object set and the data set directory we haven't looked at yet. Examination of past object trees from previous Uber blocks. You can go back to old Uber blocks and go through the tree and see what objects are still there and accessible. And even, you could even read old blocks from the disk and try and see if they've got, ZFS's object magic numbers, see if they've got useful objects. We also need to look at more pools and workloads. We didn't have compression or deduplication or any of those features on our pools. We didn't look at pools with dedicated log or cache devices either. I wouldn't expect the cache to actually change the writes much, but I don't know. And as well as our canned corporate network file system data, we also should be looking at other data or other workloads, desktops, web servers, etc. And pools providing zvols for other file systems, that's something we haven't looked at, but I think these techniques could still be useful in that situation. So yeah, summary, found that there's multiple structures that are useful. Main one that's useful is the block pointers in file objects. You can use that for just about all sorts of detection. You have to be aware that there's clock corrections and other normal and perfectly innocent behavior that could appear to be deliberate tampering with timestamps. It's up to the investigator basically to use the context of the affected files to see if it's innocent or not. And there's a lot more work needs to be done to look at other ZFS structures, other configuration options, real system with varied workloads and so on. I'd take a moment to thank BC CAN for funding my travel here and providing me an excellent opportunity to talk to BC community, hopefully get a few volunteers for the survey when it's ready. Also, my supervisor and the VU staff who've spent a year advising me, and my wife for making sure I've eaten, slept vaguely throughout the past year. On my site, research@dylanlee.net, and I think the events page, there's a formal paper where there's all the sort of statistics and raw data in a bit more detail. There's also a quick reference, which is just a list of all the commands I use if you want to just run these commands in your own systems and see what comes up. Okay, that's it. Is there any more questions? Okay, no. Yep.
What kind of changes? It would be really nice to have a list of changes to ZFS that would help, actually.
If you want to make things difficult, I'd say make sure compression is on, A time changes are off.
Why compression is such a problem? Because for me, it's just so simple to assume that the compression is on and try to compress the blocks before.
Because there's lots of forensic tools that don't even look through the file system. They just look at one end of the disk to the other, looking for magic numbers of files. It's a common thing where if you know the Word document or JPEG or something is involved in the investigation, you'd use what's called a file carver that goes from one end of the disk to the other, looking for the magic numbers at the start and end of that file and pulls them all out from wherever they are. And because compression modifies the data, you just can't use those tools. So. Yeah.
So one more question. There is ZFS encryption in Solaris, and I was wondering if it actually helps to hide modification, or if you could still detect any anomalies, wrong order of block creation and stuff like that. I'm not sure if you are familiar with ZFS.
I'm not familiar with the encryption. Encryption definitely always helps hide things, of course, obviously. It depends on if it's what level it's done at. If it's done at the objects level, or the file data level, or something like that, then it depends. But I haven't actually looked at ZFS encryption. You still might be able to detect, yeah, you still might be able to, depending on the level that the encryption is done at. Any other questions? No. Well, I'll be around for the next few days, and definitely ZFS BOF if you want to ask anything further. Thanks.
I want to remind everyone that you can give feedback on this and any talk. Go to the schedule, find the talk you just listened to, and there'll be a give feedback link in the bottom right corner. Much valued feedback.
Yeah, it's because you're testing it, but this would be the whole thing. So, well, this would be the whole thing.
Yeah, or the last one.